Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 24th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we finish with scene two, with people's reactions to the play within the play. In the scene's final sequence, Hamlet wants to know if Horatio saw Claudius's reaction. Guildenstern and Rosencrantz react to Hamlet's wildness and bring a message that the queen wants to speak with her son. Polonius arrives to do much the same, ever the tedious, redundant cog in the machine. Shakespeare never fails to entertain when his genius, Hamlet, confronts his fools, but after the laughs, he puts a button on the scene with a short soliloquy that allows Hamlet to react to himself, what he's seen, and what he now means to do. As usual, we'll be looking at the text first. The closeness between Hamlet and Horatio is well represented in the first exchange between the two friends, with Horatio teasing his friend in spite of the class difference. Directors who want to make Claudius's guilt ambiguous could use it to their advantage. Horatio is actually very critical of Hamlet's prowess as a player. He undervalues Hamlet's first ballad and critiques the second, You Might Have Rhymed, is actually very funny, and maybe critical of Hamlet's conclusions regarding his uncle. Even if the director doesn't go that route, the lines still have an ironic bent. Hamlet here represents himself as a player, but he broke character during the play with some outrageous behavior that undermines his entire experiment. So the quote, "For thou dost know, O Damon dear, this realm dismantled was of Jove himself," refers to a character from Greek myth, reputed to be a trusted friend, Damon. The realm dismantled of Jove is Denmark, as Hamlet Sr. is compared to Jove earlier in the play. And now reigns here a very, very pagic. A pagic is a peacock, which you'll often find directly substituted into the text for modern clarity. The peacock is the vain Claudius, ruling instead of the godly Jove. On the talk of the poisoning, Horatio says, "I did very well note him." So the text seems clear that he saw the same thing as Hamlet and agrees with him about Claudius's guilt. And indeed, it will soon become clear to the audience as well when we hear the king's confession. Depending on the staging, it may still be prudent to have Horatio unsure at this point, which does make him a less sincere character, but would lean into his native skepticism. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern enter, and Hamlet mocks them and the king. The king, who is in his retirement, marvelous distempered, and Hamlet says, "With drink, sir?" But since we know drink to be one of Claudius's weaknesses, the line may be taken as a stage direction to have the king drink during the play. Perhaps it's an explanation for his extreme reaction, but I don't think I've ever seen it done that way. The line, "Nay, good my lord, this courtesy is not of the right breed." Oh, a word like breed always alerts Hamlet's reader, since breeding, succession, and, yeah, sex are important themes. Hamlet is answering RNG with the wrong breed of courtesy, answering their own insincere breed of friendship, coming as they are from the wrong breed of king. Hamlet can't make them a wholesome answer because my wit's disease, he says, "but, sir, such an answer as I can make, you shall command, or rather, as you say, my mother." Hamlet's hatred for the various members of the court, guilty of his father's murder or of disrespect, is spreading. And lines like this one, where Gertrude and RNG are osmotically interchangeable, are a poetic reflection of that. When Polonius comes in later with the same news and request, he becomes interchangeable with RNG, and thus with the queen. And later, Hamlet will play word games to make father and mother equivalent, including Claudius in this guilty ensemble. And despite the ghost's return to try and rein Hamlet in, the psychic damage is done, and the play will have each of those equivalent characters die, sharing punishment as well as guilt. The exchange continues, and Hamlet eventually says, "Sir, I lack advancement." Rosencrantz, "How can that be when you have the voice of the king himself for your succession in Denmark?" Hamlet, "Aye, but sir, while the grass grows," the proverb is something musty. for a more careerist vision of Hamlet, who is driven not just by filial duty, but by ambition, this line becomes important. Claudius may have said in open court that Hamlet will succeed him. He nevertheless cut in line, as it were, by marrying Gertrude. What else is he capable of? Hamlet's exile to England has already been planned, after all. As time goes by, Claudius may change the arrangement, have Hamlet killed, or even sire his own son, depending on what age Gertrude is cast to have. Claudius must die in order for Hamlet to become king. An entirely political reading of Hamlet would see it this way. Re-enter players with recorders, and this sparks one of my favorite exchanges in the play. Clip, Branna, why look you to play upon me?
Will you play upon this pipe?
My lord, I cannot.
I pray you.
Believe me, I cannot.
I do beseech you.
I know no touch of it, my lord.
It is as easy as lying. Huh? Govern these vintages with your fingers and thumb. Give it breath with your mouth and it will discourse most eloquent music. Look you, these are the stops.
But these cannot I command to any utterance of harmony. I have not the skill.
Why, look you now, how unworthy a thing you would make of me. You would play upon me. You would seem to know my stops. You would pluck out the heart of my mystery. You would sound me from my lowest note to the top of my compass. And there is much music, excellent voice in this little organ, yet cannot you make it speak? Blood! Do you think I am easier to be played upon than a pipe? Well, call me what instrument you will, though you can fret me, yet you cannot play upon me.
I love it just for the wit of it. Even if Hamlet does use a mixed metaphor, pipes and strings. But then the pluck and fret puns are too good to pass up or criticize. Enter Polonius and Mad Hamlet making him look at clouds. This whole exchange has posed problems for modern stagings of the play. In Shakespeare's day, the play might have been performed under an open roof. And I imagine crowds looking up and trying to spot that cloud, or actors changing the animals perceived based on the clouds that day. But for Hamlet, who is in Elsinore, are they outside? Do they have access to a skylight or a window? Is the court's theater like Shakespeare's own? Or is it all just a feigned hallucination Polonius buys into as an obsessive yes man? Each director must answer that question for themselves. As everyone leaves, Hamlet has the short, witching time of night speech. In it, he promises to hurt his mother with words, probably by revealing the truth of his father's death and accusing her of damned incest. What he wants to do is hurt her physically, so the closet scene will have that tug of war between his violent impulse and a more reasoned approach. Eruptions are expected. Let's look at those adaptations, starting with the Branagh version. In the whirlwind of words and black comedy that follows The Mousetrap, I'd never really noticed before that Nick Farrell's Horatio doesn't actually confirm the king's guilt. He searches for the right words before coming up with, "I did very well note him," and is not particularly enthusiastic.
I did very well note him.
Hamlet has a moment of doubt where he goes, "Ah," before other characters walk in. Not doubt that the king is guilty, but doubt in the trust he placed in his friend. But what should he expect? At the top of the sequence, which will be another one of those whirling one-shots, Horatio is calling him out on his bad poetry as if their relationship was always one where Horatio brought the prince down to earth with a dose of his acerbic wit. But the moment quickly passes as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern arrive, and Branagh uses the line, "some music," to herald their arrival. Yes, he's about to be handed a recorder, but Hamlet is really announcing the music of words that's about to ensue. Their lies and his vicious mockeries. Hamlet is still giddy from his perceived victory and continues to giggle, impishly overact, sing-song lines in a parody of meter, and openly mock their every word, speaking to them as if they were deaf and dumb, and making grandly theatrical gestures. He's still at the theater. For their part, R&G have grown bold enough to show anger towards him. They know Hamlet has gone too far and fully throw their support to the king. This is a mistake. And as if to foreshadow their eventual fate, Hamlet becomes violent with them. The prince handles that pipe like a weapon, here choking Guildenstern, there slashing the air with it as if it were a rapier. There's another sudden change of attitude in Hamlet when Polonius walks in, another fool who now thinks nothing of showing angry impatience at the mad prince. Hamlet basically gives the same performance twice here. He's impish and overly theatrical and turns to bitterness and anger. He just does it all much more quickly. It's really a reaction to Polonius's tedious redundancy. Hamlet repeats behavior more efficaciously. For once, Polonius doesn't want to drag things out either, so he agrees to every fantastical cloud in the ceiling just to get it over with.
Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel?
By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed.
Methinks 'tis like a weasel.
It is backed like a weasel.
Or like a whale.
Very like a whale.
Then I will come to my mother by and by.
The sequence ends with Hamlet asking his friends to leave him, and the word drips with sarcasm. One of the few changes made to the play's structure in Branagh's integral adaptation occurs here, as we cut to Act 3, Scene 3, before the short soliloquy that usually ends Scene 2. In Scene 3, RNG plays sycophants to Claudius, Polonius tells the king he'll hide behind an heiress in the queen's closet, and the king heads for the chapel. The function of the edit is to get Hamlet's "I'm now ready to do anything" speech closer to Claudius' confession. In fact, the soliloquy is dropped in just before the confession, and its last lines are even juxtaposed to Claudius entering the confessional, so that "my soul, consent" precedes Claudius' prayer, highlighting the thematic connection between the two. In both cases, what is done falls short of what is said. Hamlet will not kill Claudius, and Claudius does not repent. Neither man's conscience manages to become more like the other's. It's a failed osmosis. As the court leaves the theater in Olivier's film, Hamlet sings his lines, throwing his torch in the air jubilantly. He becomes so manic, in fact, that Horatio can hardly keep up and isn't given enough time to confirm or deny the king's reaction, although it was pretty dramatic and clear. Olivier compresses a lot of the action, so there are a number of cuts, including, sadly, the pipe metaphor. This is, after all, a version of the play without Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. A few of their lines are given to Polonius instead, which tends to make him less scatterbrained at the start of the sequence, and then seems to make him press the issue as he repeats the summons in his own. Instead of focusing on Hamlet's madness in the moment, Olivier makes lines like "my wit's diseased," as level-headed as any.
"Sir, I cannot make you a wholesome answer. My wit's diseased."
There's a solid confidence in his treatment of Polonius, and when he points to clouds in a dark corner of the castle, never even looking in that direction, he's serious and cruel. He's not acting crazy, not seeing things, or even feigning hallucinations. He's testing how far Polonius's sycophancy goes. He never takes his eyes off the old man, implicitly telling him that he owns him. "I am the master here, and you do well to know your place, you who would command me to go to my mother's closet." It's a brilliant representation of what's going on under the surface of the cloud exchange.
"Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in shape of a camel?"
"By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed."
"Methinks 'tis like a weasel."
"It is backed like a weasel."
"Or like a whale."
"Very like a whale."
"Then I will come to my mother by and by."
"I will say so."
By and by is easily said, isn't spoken to Polonius, but as a thoughtful aside. Olivier takes a verbal dagger and points it at Hamlet himself. By and by means in a moment and implies a delay, so of course we're reminded of his forever delayed revenge. Easily sworn, but the deadline is something that lacks definition, and the doing is much more difficult. It is somewhat moving that the camera lingers on Horatio here after he's dismissed. He wasn't really consulted and sees that he cannot truly help his friend, especially since he strikes me as someone who would never counsel going through with the murder. The following soliloquy starts with Hamlet, his back to us, so that you can't initially tell if he's speaking the words or using voiceover. He is facing utter darkness. When he turns, we see he was indeed speaking the lines, but the original confusion has put you in the right frame of mind. We are hearing a man's inner thoughts. He then starts to go up some stairs towards his mother's closet, looking up at a godlike beam of light. Olivier has crafted an image here that shows Hamlet going from dark to light, from doubt to decision, and at the same time relates to the king's own dilemma, as in the next scene, we will see his words going up, but his thoughts remaining below. Hamlet's own pledge here will be as empty as the king's own prayers, though. Like Olivier's before him, Jacoby's Hamlet sings the opening lines of this sequence, and like Branagh's after him, He infuses the word friends with sarcasm and has similar, almost violent mannerisms. For example, mock-punching Rosencrantz at Pickers and Feelers and almost jamming the recorder into Guildenstern's teeth. However, there's something very different being done with the staging and something that inspires a new reading of the text. There looks to be a very definite play on Jacoby's part on class and position. Hamlet starts out standing on a chair, then comes down eye level to RNG, falls on his knees before them, and finally kisses their feet, from prince to slave, over the course of a conversation. This is intriguing because it's a conversation in which Hamlet also claims to lack advancement. He's being incredibly ironic, not only mocking the rise of RNG as sycophants, seeking just such an advancement, and warning them that the grass is indeed also growing for them. All gardening metaphors are suspect in the play, ever since Hamlet called Denmark a rank and unweeded garden. And here, the grass proverb is musty. Things grow in corrupted form in Hamlet's Denmark, and RNG are liable to choke on the weeds, and in a way do. And in another sense, they are weeds. In the text, there's also a play on class in regards to Horatio, but those few lines are some of the rare cuts in this adaptation. You might have rhymed and so on. That's all gone. This Horatio is less brazen than other interpretations of the character, and less able to speak truth to power. There is obvious fear of Hamlet in his performance, and a sense that when he says, "I did very well note him," he rather means, "I did very well note you." In this version, remember, Claudius did not really give himself away. There was a standoff, but the slick politician seems to have come out of it unblemished, while Hamlet appeared completely out of his mind. And as usual, Hamlet will dismiss those he doesn't agree with, lest he hears what he doesn't want to hear. When Polonius comes in, Hamlet seems to notice the camel-shaped cloud for the first time, and appears genuinely distracted. But the bitterness that ensues reveals it's probably an act.
"Do you see yonder cloud?
It's almost in shape of a camel. By the mass, it is like a camel indeed.
Methinks it's like a weasel.
It is backed like a weasel.
Or a whale.
Very like a whale.
Then I will come to my mother by and by. They fool me to the top of my bent. I will come by and by.
I will say so.
By and by is easily said."
The cloud exists in this version on a fresco that acts as a backdrop to the play within the play. Not that any of its clouds look like particular animals. It's against the background of gods in the heavens that Hamlet's hellish soliloquy is then ironically spoken, his hands full of weapons, yet promising not to use them on his mother. As the staging piles on the ironies, so too do the text's ironies become more noticeable. Think of it, Hamlet has just, in his mind, exposed the king's guilt, and is ready to finally commit violence. And yet, it's to his mother's closet he now goes. Upon her invitation, of course. But if he's so ready to act, why not go directly to the king and murder him? It's because he finds her guilty as well, and indeed makes her the priority over the king. This inner battle has been going on since the start of the play when, in fact, the queen started out guiltier than the king. Before the revelation of a murder, there was only the betrayal of a husband. It's something that continues to blunt Hamlet's purpose. An important difference with the Zeffirelli adaptation is that the revels continue even after members of the court scurry for the exits. It's an odd choice, one that devalues the king's power, though it does better match Hamlet's state of mind. His own song and dance is even more over the top than elsewhere, and he clearly sends such words as wounded deer in the king's direction so that it might be heard. The entire performance is witnessed by Gertrude, who stands shocked and amazed before finally leaving. Hamlet doesn't have much of a conversation with Horatio before running off, so his friend's reaction remains ambiguous, though Claudius was pretty obvious in his reaction. And in the wake of all this, we keep finding fragments of the nunnery scene. Hamlet tells Ophelia to leave one more time, kisses her, and gives her a matter-of-fact farewell.
"Believe none of us. We are arrant knaves, all. To a nunnery go, and quickly too. Oh well."
You can practically see her mind breaking. A change of venue, and we're on a parapet, somewhere else. Though not too long later, since Hamlet has a drum around his neck and a recorder in his hand. He's accosted by Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but he's obviously had time to settle down and is relatively serious and even friendly with them. The better to take a darker turn in the middle of a line, specifically at it is as easy as lying. Guildenstern is particularly sarcastic with his "I have not the skill," which sets Hamlet off to violence and to choking him with a pipe. The true irony is, in fact, that they really don't have the skill. Neither music, lying, or getting information from Hamlet. One could probably write a dissertation on this idea. People in the play are consistently required to do things for which they have not the skill, whether it's RNG's undercover work, Polonius's counsel, Claudius's confession, heck, Claudius's rule of Denmark, or indeed Hamlet's bloody revenge. What is easy on the surface may not be so simple, and I'm constantly reminded of "To thine own self be true" as the key to the play. Polonius does not feature in this sequence, so no mysterious clouds this time. Instead, RNG gets some of his lines and are left to easily transmit the prince's message. Of course, easy has been so far beyond their grasp. Hamlet runs down the stairs away from them for his brief soliloquy, which is even briefer, ending the scene on "Now to my mother."
'Tis now the very witching time of night, when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on. Soft now to my mother.
In other words, he places no conditions on that visit, and after speaking of drinking hot blood and doing bitter business, the lack of such makes us believe he's off to murder Gertrude. It's an omission that creates tension, certainly, but thrown on top of the change of venue, it beggars the question of why Claudius is not more in his thoughts. The guilt of the king spreading to the queen is a central element of the play. I could, in fact, have switched king and queen in that statement and still been correct. But by forgetting the king entirely, it's not well served. Once again, I find myself frowning at Zeffirelli's cuts. In Hamlet 2000, we don't stay in the theater long. Horatio and Marcella noted Claudius's blenching at the movie screen, as did we, but seem more confused than certain. Still, in cases where the actor playing the king isn't ambiguous in his reaction, there's no real need to dwell on Horatio's. Hamlet races off into the night as we hear the ballad's words in voiceover. It takes an entirely different bent, spoken as internal monologue.
Some must watch, while some must sleep. Thus runs the world away.
In the play as written, the lines are a manifestation of Hamlet's exultant victory. Here, it becomes commentary on the evening's events. Some must watch, some must sleep, and so it goes. He's saying that only a few, like him, are vigilant, and the world outside is still oblivious to Claudius's crimes. There's still much work to be done, and the melancholy of Hamlet's tone shows him still weary, despite his small victory. He hails a cab and jumps in, and that's where Rosencrantz and Guildenstern catch up to him and box him in. As the cab drives off, we hear words on the radio, but not from the play. It's a commercial for buckling up, because only cats have nine lives. It informs the scene only in the smallest degree. It's about danger and safety, something all the participants are ignoring. They're all playing a dangerous game. The difference between RNG and Hamlet is that the twins don't realize it. In fact, Hamlet will survive his deadly encounter with them, he's the cat, and they will not. But here, the prince is caught, and though he tries to remain aloof, he does wipe at his wet eyes from time to time. In the absence of recorders, because this version frequently does away with lines about anachronistic props, their conversation ends at "my wit's diseased." He cannot give an answer, and that is that. He's not playing coy, as other Hamlets do. He's frankly telling them they are unlikely to get anything from him. When he gets off, part of the witching hour speech is done in voiceover. It's all about mood here. Heavy metal leaks out of a revolving door. Is it the ghost's passageway to and from the undiscovered country or something? Steam blows out of sewer grates. And in a few moments, as we cut to Claudius heading out of Elsinore, he crosses paths with a child dressed as a ghost who boos at him. It's Halloween in New York, apparently. And it's a nice ironic image that a dead child would haunt the king at this point. He who killed his brother, someone he grew up with, was a child with. It comes after an enigmatic scene in which Hamlet is seen bothering a limo driver, but as we'll see, that's merely setting up the confessional scene. After the king leaves in Fodor's experimental version, Hamlet's insane clapping draws a hateful look from Polonia, who, you'll remember, in this universe, is Claudius's lover. Polonius's change of gender has several effects, but one of them is creating a dynamic that makes attacks on Claudius that much more personal for his counselor. Counselor and chief accomplice? The king obviously blenched, and Horatio really did note him, and so she shares in Hamlet's joy. There's no bitterness in the two friends. Fodor treats this as a victory, as yet untainted by what must come after. When Hamlet calls for the recorders, it's in a gently mocking, celebratory tone, a way of smoothing over the fact that it's really a clarinet and not a medieval recorder that he finds.
Upon the talk of poisoning.
I did very well note him.
Come, some music. Come, the recorders.
It's amazing how an actor can simply put a little humor or sarcasm into a single word and modernize it immediately. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, dangerous bullies in this world, are really angry and do a lot of shouting out of their frustration. They're at the end of their collective rope. In fact, their reaction is so strong that Hamlet's I am tame shames them into a quieter stance.
Put your discourse into some frame and start not so wildly from my affair.
I'm tame, sir. Pronounce.
The queen, your mother.
They're the ones who seem crazy, not him. Instead of the aggressive, threatening madness most Hamlets put on in this sequence, this one instead goes for innocent playfulness, as a man-boy who doesn't understand why people are angry at him. Even his partner in this affair, Horatio, quietly smiles next to him, somehow acting as Hamlet's irony. It's how RNG know that they're being laughed at. No matter how much they threaten him with body language and tone, Hamlet doesn't lose his composure. On As Easy as Lying, he makes it a discovery, an answer, inspired by looking at them. And there's no violence in this business with the recorders. He just gives them the clarinet and begs them to play it. More a petulant child than a dangerous man in his own right. They hesitate before admitting to not knowing how and roughly disassembling the instrument before giving it back. Again, an implied threat. By the time Hamlet gets to You Cannot Play Upon Me, Polonia is standing behind RNG, and the remark is addressed to her as much as to them, if not more so. Through the innocent act, he lets slip that he knows they're all in league with each other. The imaginary cloud in the ceiling plays out as a power struggle. Polonia refusing to be intimidated, her response is dripping with sarcasm to let him know she's quite aware of what he's doing.
Do you see yonder cloud that's in the shape of a camel?
By the mass, it is like a camel indeed.
Methinks it is like a weasel.
It is backed like a weasel.
Or like a whale.
Very like a whale.
I will come to my mother by and by. I will come by and by.
There is further osmosis between the conspirators at the end of the sequence when by and by is easily said is spoken to RNG instead of Polonia. But they put a further twist on it. RNG each get one bye thrown in their direction, making it bye and bye, like bye-bye, a pun on their quick dismissal directly following. Horatio then leads him out of the room by the hand. That's a gesture that could be interpreted as either romantic or childish, but a suspenseful sound stops him. Does he feel the ghost? A gun left on a chair. It might have fallen out of RNG's pockets. Draws his attention. And he fondles it as he says his speech, a prayer to the gods of violence. These choices are informed by the modern staging of the play in the film. Hamlet does not carry a weapon, so must procure one. And the witching hour cannot be heralded by bells or some such, so a strange feeling comes upon the prince instead. It's a supernatural occurrence, this weapon suddenly materializing when Hamlet needs to kill the king. Supernatural forces may well be at work. In the Tenet version, the sequence doesn't start with the usual rhymes, but instead with Horatio trying to tell Hamlet that what he noted, most definitely, was not conclusive proof of Claudius's guilt.
Oh, good Horatio! I'll take the ghost word for £1,000!
It's perceived!
Very well, my lord.
Upon the talk of the poisoning!
I did very well note him.
Come, some music! Come!
Hamlet won't listen, of course, an almost violent euphoria overtaking him. He asks for music, but he also grabs a silver tray from a servant, banging it in the man's face like a gong. Horatio attends him and laughs at his jests, but he doesn't speak or try to broach the subject of the king again. The focus changes, in any case, to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. surely Horatio's rivals in the friendship department, so perhaps there's a psychological, personal reason why he falls in with Hamlet again, despite this unspoken disagreement. David Tennant's Hamlet is at his funniest in this scene.
The king, sir.
Aye, sir, what of him?
Is in his retirement marvellous distempered.
With drink, sir.
No, my lord, rather with choler.
His with drink is impish and a confidential, oh, he's drunk again, eh? Yeah, that happens a lot. It's traitor's talk that makes RNG co-conspirators, if anyone were listening. As they continue, Hamlet more or less ignores them, putting the player's crown on his head, using the silver tray as a mirror, hiding his face from them. He's there mocking the king he should have been, if only they and the rest of the court would follow the right man, the true heir. He's also mocking Claudius, sitting on the throne, misunderstanding everything they say on purpose. It's a sly condemnation of Claudius' decisions to date, prefiguring Denmark's downfall at the hands of Fortinbras. When they demand an answer from him, he raises his hand excitedly like a schoolboy, only to reveal he can't make a wholesome one. It's with mock pride that he says the "Oh, wonderful son" line.
Wonderful son that can so astonish a mother.
It's all a caricature of his false king slash father. And he does the same with the friendship he bears these men. At Pickers and Feelers, he gets up to tickle Rosencrantz, freaking him out. And they should freak out. They're failing at their appointed task, and that will have consequences. For this Rosencrantz, it's really about getting it over with so he can leave this hellish place before the axe falls on him. He tries to keep back. He's rather sincere when he asks Hamlet to stop what he's doing before it ruins them all. Guildenstern is the more political, albeit gauche, animal. He tries to find the right words and hopes to get favor from the king. But of course, neither of them are aware that Claudius may be a murderer and usurper. They just don't get it, perhaps because they can't. It's shown, for example, when Rosencrantz gives Hamlet a blank stare at "While the grass grows." There's a funny beat before the next line, and Hamlet obnoxiously slaps him, but doesn't awaken him to the very real danger of trusting Claudius. The recorders arrive, and the production plays on the plural in that line to make Hamlet throw one to Horatio, which will soon pay off. But first, the interplay between Hamlet and Guildenstern is sweeter and less violent than usual. Initially, Hamlet acts all innocent, not understanding why Guildenstern won't play the pipe and laughing at the irony. Gil, for his part, tries to understand what is being said and takes the prince's explanations with a measure of respect, as if he agrees he's been rumbled. Then bam, a rare musical sting accompanies Hamlet attacking Guildenstern with the pipe, trying to choke him, even as Rosencrantz tries to gently separate them. What actually does is Polonius's arrival. Walking into a violent moment, Polonius gets a loud pipeful in the face, followed by Hamlet and Horatio playing a tune together over his words. The tune they play is Three Blind Mice. So how does that go again? Three blind mice, see how they run. They all ran after the farmer's wife, who cut off their tails with a carving knife. Did you ever see such a thing in your life as three blind mice? So, Hamlet Sr. as the farmer, Hamlet Jr. as his knife, and the mice are his victims, specifically Polonius, Rosencrantz, and Guildenstern in this scene, with the implication of adultery with people running after the farmer's wife. That works, especially considering Hamlet's cries of a rat, as he murders Polonius. The production motivates Polonius's presence by having the old counselor mouth words at RNG with a certain degree of ire. Thematically, I've said that Polonius is entirely redundant in this scene because he always makes the wrong choices and that Hamlet feels he's irrelevant at all times. Here he comes because RNG are taking too long. We have to remember, he plans to hide in the queen's closet, even if he hasn't said so yet, so his impatience stems from that. He's been kept waiting as much as the queen has. Showing impatience and even anger is rare for him, so perhaps his head is also on the chopping block. When the king is angry, chaos reigns in Elsinore. And it's because he's impatient and in a hurry that Hamlet chooses to play the game of clouds with him, seeing if he'll show this respect. Polonius catches himself each time, but his composure does break. The soliloquy is done straight into Hamlet's movie camera, a point of view we get to see. Sitting askew on the throne while he speaks of being cruel to his mother creates a visual inversion of what is natural and may put the lie to his words. Hamlet looks quite demented here. His successive victories over Claudius, RNG, and Polonius have pushed him over the line of what may be reasonable or acceptable.
'Tis now the very witching time of night, when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on.
The only part of the sequence that makes it into Slings and Arrows' performance montage is the soliloquy, but we don't see it. Instead, we are with the play's director, Jeffrey Tennant, played by Paul Gross, mouthing the words backstage, praying to the Shakespearean gods for a good outcome. In the show, Jeffrey was a much-praised Hamlet until he cracked on stage. And the witching hour, in terms of that story, is when he must redeem himself and walk back from that disaster, even through a proxy here. As the soliloquy ends, he signals the number of soliloquies to the actress playing Gertrude, a countdown that refers to the 5 key moments an actor must nail as he gets through the play, something he told Jack Crew to reassure him that this performance was possible. In relating it to the play, it refers to Hamlet's delay of the action, a self-imposed countdown that creates the tension in the play. Hamlet is a time bomb. Each soliloquy counted down is a means to talk himself into taking action. And by the end, when all the soliloquies are done, words turn to action and the dialogue shrinks until the rest is, indeed, silence. Let's talk comics adaptations. The black comedy of the recorder exchange between Hamlet and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern cannot be easily reproduced on the page, not with the page count inherent to the format. So I'm sad to report the sequence was cut from, in fact, both versions of Classics Illustrated. RNGs still show up to deliver the Queen's message, but it acts merely as prologue to Hamlet's soliloquy. This is especially true of the original comic, which has Hamlet spare his cruelties, unless you consider an abrupt answer to be cruel. Note also that the bloodier language was excised from the speech, pitching it to its younger audience. Tom Mandrake's adaptation uses an entire page, but it's still very economical. Hamlet's delirious rhymes are kept, but spoken over the panel in which the king runs off, showing more clearly that he is the stricken deer of Hamlet's song. Mandrake's gloomy Hamlet has a very different expression from the original Classics Illustrated too, replacing joy with anguish. Gone is the euphoria, and in its place is the realization that now he must carry out his bloody revenge. For this Hamlet, it's made things worse, and it seems he'd rather have been told that the ghost was lying and was just tormenting him. RNG's arrival restores a lot of the dialogue lost in the original comic, but still no recorder business, which would probably have been bitter and violent rather than manic. In fact, Hamlet's response, cutting to a later line in the scene, is almost a non sequitur. By and by is easily said, seems strange here, but it's basically Hamlet telling them what answer to give without the prompt of it being their own plain answer. The comic's form shows another of its weaknesses at adaptation when Hamlet starts his speech in the same panel where he dismisses his friends, making it look like they'll hear that part of it. However, it does kind of work and makes the witching hour the reason for their dismissal. Instead of saying it's late, Hamlet goes into poetic detail that likens night to evil. I could see this used in a proper staging of the play as a way to give Hamlet another madness moment in front of the traitors, putting a mirror up to their own evil or acting as a veiled threat. The rest of the speech is as written and performed alone, either with Hamlet in close-up or walking towards his mother's closet. Well, that ends our look at Act 3, Scene 2, Part 3. Next week, Claudius confesses to the murder. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll return, dear listener, for Act 3, Scene 3, The Confessional.
The rest is silence.